You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Around the Block with Bruce and Susan. Boy, is it going to be exciting, too. Got a lot to talk about. I think we had a Facebook post here where it's going to generate some content behind that Susan reminded me of this morning. And plus, we have a special announcement. Unless it's too soon to make that special announcement.
We could make it.
Okay, so make it, and you just tell people when to pull the trigger on it.
It's live. Live.
So it's without further ado, Susan, go ahead, pick it up.
We have been talking about last couple of weeks that about this third book we're working on, we were in the final. It was off to the editor, and then we were in final editing, and it is now live on Amazon, Unlocking Federal Halfway House and Home Confinement Under the Second Chance Act, affectionately referred to as the Red Book. It is now available for purchase. It is similar to our last two books. It is a in-detail, comprehensive guide to the Second Chance Act. We talk about kind of the origins of halfway house and home confinement. I always like to, it's kind of the academic in me. I like to provide some context and some history. So we talk about kind of the origins of federal halfway house and home confinement and what was going on before the Second Chance Act. We talk about the upheaval of the OLC memo, the Office of Legal Counsel out of Maine Justice, back 25 years ago now, almost 25 years ago, that kind of turned everything up on its head. And really, it was precipitated the Second Chance Act. And then we talk about the five-factor review and what it is and what it covers. But I think the most important part, and Bruce, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the most important part of the book is really educating people on how to talk about their release needs and the different issues related to reentry. And that reentry is not as simple as, do you have a house? Do you have a home and a job? That it's more nuanced than that. And what resources are individuals going to need, and how to talk about that with your unit team. And then, of course, the timeline. When should you be talking about halfway house and home confinement? And, by the policy benchmarks that exist and when case managers should be bringing these topics up. But, as you and I kind of advocate with our clients, and we talk about on Facebook and we talk about here, is the importance of self-advocacy. And the only way you can effectively advocate for yourself is to get educated. And that's what this book is about. And so I'm very excited. It is part of joins our first two books and our kind of affectionately referred to as our Unlocking series. That's not going to be its formal name, but kind of it's the Unlocking series. So Bruce, thoughts?
No, I'm excited, and folks, this book is going to be more for almost everybody. Right. Because, you don't have to be, you don't have to have a certain pattern risk or whatever for First Step Act is its own thing. And so this is really going to apply to so many more families, so many more inmates. And so folks, definitely, if you have somebody who's serving time in a medium or a USP or whatever, it looks like they might be releasing from a USP or a medium, definitely get this book because there's some things that they can do to help. Obviously folks that are in this, probably for another show, but, Susan and I, and a lot of, I was talking to a penitentiary warden just the other week We want people to be able to reintegrate into society. And sometimes people coming that have done longer sentences, right? 10, 15, 20 years, or people that have been in gladiator school or been into some sort of a rougher prison, right? You just need time to kind of get into society and kind of ease into it, versus just going straight to the house. So that's where those release needs and having a release plan and being able to articulate, just like Susan said, be able to articulate, you know, why you may need extra time. Now, we've actually had white collar offenders that got some extra SCA time because if they were in financial security, they lost that. They got to learn a whole new trade. Or if they were a doctor, they lost that, right? And they need a whole new trade. They maybe need some time, more time, right, to get situated or what have you. So,
absolutely. I was a case management coordinator at a USP when the Second Chance Act passed. And it was just kind of reflecting back. I can remember talking to one of my case managers who had transferred to my facility and from another penitentiary. And she was overwhelmed with the volume of work that she was doing and had said, you know, if I did 2 halfway house packages a year with a penitentiary caseload, that was a lot. And now she was doing, you know, I'm not saying she was doing, you know, dozens a month, but she went from doing 2 a year to doing 10 and 15 a month and was really kind of overwhelmed with the workload change.
How many were you doing at Carswell Camp alone?
Oh my gosh. The camps I at any given time,
or Seymour.
Too. At one time, when I was at Seymour Johnson, I actually counted my turnover. And over the course of 12 months, I released as many people as was on my caseload. Obviously, it wasn't the same people, but was turning over. You know, I had a caseload 145, 150 back then. That was before they dropped the caseload ratios down. So I think I had 140, 150 folks at any given time and was doing either straight releases for individuals with real short sentence, because, you know, we're talking pre-FSA. So if you had less than 6 months, you didn't get anything.
But
either between street releases and halfway house releases, I was doing about 140, 150 a year. And that pretty much held with at Carswell as well, when the camp. Obviously, moving inside, the numbers were different. You know, I worked that mental health unit and the medical unit. So, you know, we had a lot of folks who couldn't manage halfway house, right?
Right.
And of course, the inpatient unit, half of that were pre-trialers, and the other half were transitioning to therapeutic settings. They weren't going to.
I remember my days where you and I'd be in the same team at the camp, and be out there, looking at a lot of people that were coming out onto RRC. And I know you're doing a ton of RRC packets from the camp, and I remember that. Anyway, long story short, this is a very important piece of every federal inmate's journey. Okay. And so we're excited about this book just because it applies to so many more people, you know, virtually everybody, but a lot of folks. So.
Absolutely. So, when we were talking about getting ready for the show today we've talked a lot about the different issues related to the First Step Act. And we've been talking about some of the recent court cases. And I know we've done a couple of shows where we've talked about cases, and we just had a really interesting case that oddly enough touches on the content of all three books we've done. And I thought it was just kind of a really fun, unique opportunity. to talk about the different aspects and how, whether it's FSA, SCA, or custody classification, the overlap. And, you know, while the books kind of stand on their own, right? You want to learn about an FSA, you get the FSA book. You want to learn about custody classification, you can get that one. And now the Second Chance Act. But they really also work and they complement each other. And this particular case that we've got that we're going to talk about today, I think really kind of typifies that. So we had had a family member reach out to us. Their loved one had some issues with their custody classification. And actually they reached out to us first about their pattern risk level, right? And as we've talked about before, is, you know, the pattern risk assessment, does the case managers don't do anything with it. They hit the button to generate it because the pattern risk assessment is fully automated and it's pulling information from different sources within the BOP's computer system, inmate computer system. So it's pulling from classification, it's pulling from disciplinary history, it's pulling from education and programming, and it's pulling this information together and it's generating this risk assessment. So, and we talk about this in our unlocking book in solving problems when you're having difficulties with your pattern, is you have to look at the source document. And in this case, the issue was the source document was his custody classification, right? So he had two errors on his custody classification. One was from initial designation. The second was from his first program review, which is his second meeting. You know, you have your initial classification first, and then you have your first program review. And every team meeting after that is a program review. And at the first program review, that's when custody classification is also is the first custody classification. And in this individual's case, it wasn't until his custody classification. So he had been in the system 7 months when he discovered that he had an escape history scored against him. And so he gets with his case manager and, you know, they realize that the DSCC folks entered something as an escape history that really wasn't. And the case manager, and this is something that shouldn't happen, but it does. Right. Sometimes when case managers are doing that initial classification, they're transferring information over from the designation data, not expecting a change to happen that quickly, right? And that's what happened. They transcribed it over and didn't actually look at the PSR to confirm the information that they were looking at. And you know, designation process, it's still human beings. They can make mistakes. You can have rookie people that are reviewing the PSR at DSCC and make a mistake as to, is this a history of escape or is it not? Okay. So they caught that error. But because that was actually caught after the team, after the pattern risk assessment was generated, the case manager was like, oh, well, you know, you're just going to have, you know, next time around, we'll do this. And so they reached out to us and is like, well, wait a minute, how is this going to work? So we did a full pre-sentence investigation report review. And in fact, the escape history was incorrectly ranked in as far as being scored, but that didn't change his overall, that didn't bring him down enough so that he can go from medium to low. But what we discovered was he had a history of violence that was over 15 years old and was still being scored as 10 to 15. Now, the interesting part to this was at designation, it was appropriately 10 to 15 years old. At his initial classification, it was appropriately 10 to 15 years old. But it was between that first month and that seventh month that he went over the 15-year mark. That alone was, that was enough points to now change his overall risk level, because of course, history of violence, like history of escape, are scored on the custody classification and are imported into pattern. And so he was now in this situation of his pattern risk level was going to come down. Okay. But he had to go back to his case manager and say, you made another mistake. And really importantly, and we talk about this in depth in the Blue Book, is when the mistake was made and how much time has lapsed since the mistake was made kind of is what tracks how difficult it is to fix. And in this case, it should have been caught when the case manager did his custody classification review last year. And if it had been done correctly last year, then last year he would have dropped to low risk, which means when he came back to team 6 months later, this would have been his first consecutive review. So what had to be done? Well, first, the case manager had to fix the custody classification. Then the case manager had to reach out through unit manager and case management coordinator to get the regional office involved. So the regional office could get the central office involved, because now we didn't just deal with having to correct custody classification. We actually had to correct the guy's record, because the record would show him with the updated custody classification and then generating an update pattern risk assessment, it would have looked like he just dropped to low risk. And yes, he would have gotten his 10 days a month that he had been getting before that. The problem is, as everyone knows, once you drop to low risk, you have to have two consecutive assessments where you maintain low risk. And we didn't want it to be reflecting that he just dropped. It needed to be reflecting that he dropped last year, six and a half months ago, almost 7 months ago. So, of course, you know, we reached out to the institution saying, hey, you're going to need to do this. And he's talking to his case manager. Case manager does the custody classification. They've got the regional office involved. We reached out to central office to say, hey, regional office is going to have to be reaching out to you about this case and passed on, so that everybody was like waiting for the case manager to fix the custody classification and then hit the pattern button so that we'd get a new clean pattern. And then they had to go back and literally rebuild his record, ignoring the bad patterns, the ones that were done that showed he was still medium risk and showing that this history of violence was 10 to 15 years old when it wasn't. And so now he's looking at having been determined last year, and now it's officially in his FSA assessment. He's had his first assessment. Now he's waiting on his second. But now that presents a different problem, right? And that's where the Red Book comes along, right? So when we talk about halfway house, and one of the things we talk about a lot in this book is the difference between unpredictable events, right? Mm-hmm. Getting a sentence reduction, unpredictable. I mean, yes, you file motions and you're hoping it comes through, but if and when it actually comes through, it's unpredictable. You don't know if and when it's going to happen. And when it does, it changes the dynamics of your sentence. But we also talk about the unplanned for events, not right. paying attention to, you know, you've got a 15-month sentence. You come in, you're at your initial classification. You still have a good conduct time release date. So your case manager sets your team off for 6 months. Except you're FSA eligible and your minimum risk level. And as soon as you hit your 30 days, the calculator is going to generate a conditional release date and boom, you're under a year from release, but not planning for that to happen. And we get the case managers have been told, do not try to manually calculate it yourself. But now, if you know, yes, go ahead, Bruce.
Weren't they just given the ability finally to see certain things?
They do, but the first information, that first
right,
that first FSA assessment worksheet doesn't come out until the individual's been there at least 30 days. That's true. Case managers have to team within 28 days, which means they're going into team with a good conduct time release date and not an FSA release date. But what we encourage our clients to do, and we're encouraging anyone listening, is if you're walking into federal prison with a short sentence, right? And we use the, I think we use in the book, I think we use the example of a 15-month sentence, I think. I don't remember right now. But if you're walking into federal prison with a 15-month sentence, and you're sitting initial classification and your case manager is talking about a release date that's more than a year away and we're going to see you in 6 months, you know, if you're knowledgeable, if you understand the process, what's your first question going to be? Well, you know, my FSA time is going to kick in next week or within 2 weeks. And then my conditional date is going to be there. And, you know, I have a 15-month sentence and, you know, that's going to move my conditional release date to less than a year. Are you going to schedule a special team to talk about for me? So, you know, are you going to submit my paperwork after my release date is updated? You know, asking those questions. And that's what we do in the book, as we talk about the kinds of questions individuals need to be asking their case manager, not in a confrontational or argumentative way, but just a, hey, I understand the process. I know you've got a lot on your plate. Are we going to do this as a special team? Are you going to just, are you going to change it and have me come back in 90 days? What are you, what's your plan? And so that's the situation our client's in right now, right? Is so now we've got 4 months of FSA has been applied and his conditional release date has, is now in place. And instead of having a release date that's later in 2028, he is now has a conditional release date in the fall of next year. So he is well under that 17 to 19 month timeline when we would talk about halfway house, right? And on top of that, he's only at the 10-day earning rate. So while he's
gonna
not
go down again,
he's going to go down again. So while he's not scheduled for team for the fall, by the time he comes back to team, right, his, he's not going to be less than a year from release at that point. I mean, he's, instead of being just under a year from release, which he would be right now, that 15 days is going to kick in, creates a new conditional release date, which is going to bump him down further. And if the case management staff hasn't talked about halfway house yet, like everybody's going to be behind the curve on this. So, you know, we've provided some guidance to him about going back and asking for a special team, talking to his case manager, and, you know, have provided him that guidance. And that's one of the things we talk about in the book. What is a special team? How does that work? Where is that in policy that I can ask for a special team? And so, you know, that's where he's at right now, is he's looking at being like 15 months from release now.
Yeah.
Hasn't been recommended for halfway house, hasn't even talked about release plans yet. And it's because all of this just happened because of a single error. And again, if the case manager was looking at the PSR and maybe they just saw the year of his conviction and didn't pay attention to the month.
Right.
Because when he was at his initial classification, it was correct. And it was like, I think it was maybe 2.5-3 months after his initial classification is when he had his 15-year anniversary. So when he came back to team, he appropriately had dropped. It wasn't caught. And like I said, now we're, you know, seven and a half months. I'm looking at my calendar, seven and a half months passed. And so now, like, he has all these hoops to jump through, and the case manager needs them. They need to pull them back in. They need to make a recommendation. And those are the kinds of things that can happen when things aren't planned for, not paying to pay attention to the impact of FSA, not paying attention to anniversary dates as they apply to custody classification. those have huge, huge impacts for folks. Even things like relocation. We were talking to someone today who's looking at needing a relocation. Now he's got a little bit longer sentence, and so he's going to have
some time to do
it. He's going to have some time, but we also have cases where they're walking in the door with 21 month sentences and they're telling us, you know, yeah, they're not, you know, we always ask, where were you sentenced? Where are you releasing? And sometimes we're like, well, I don't know where I'm going to go. Like, I don't know what halfway house. And I'm like, no. You were sentenced in the Southern District of Ohio. Is that where you're going to go back and do your supervised release? Oh, no, that's just where I caught my case. I'm from North Carolina. Well, okay, there are rules about that. We actually put a whole chapter in the Second Chance Act book on relocation and that process. People think it's the Bureau's rule. It's actually a function of their order. So when someone is sentenced, you know, they get a term of incarceration, they may get fines, restitution, but they get that supervised release term. And that supervised release term is issued by the court for service in that district. So the Bureau can't just send someone to another district unless they have a release plan for that district.
Right.
And then they have to send a packet to that probation office.
Get a new home inspection.
Home inspection. Make sure everything. I've had, going back to Seymour Johnson days, I remember getting a denial of a relocation. And bless their heart, the person didn't even speak to the particular family member. And there was some bad feelings over the incarceration and prison term. And the person did not want them in their home, but they didn't even know about it. And so literally I'm calling this person, this younger fella, not young, but he was in his early 30s. Funnily enough, older than me at the time, because I was just a baby then, in his early 30s. And I'm like, hey, did you talk to this person about your plan to come live with them? Well, no, I just figured that. I'm like, okay, well, that was a mistake, because not only did they not know, they told the probation office, no. So we need to think about another plan. And again, it may seem obvious, like if you're going to go plan to live with someone, you have that conversation first, but that's why we put it in the book.
Right. Don't make assumptions.
Yeah. Don't make assumptions. I had another case, not mine. I was involved in it in my capacity in central office, and they didn't do a relocation. Unfortunately, when they started working through the process, it was a little bit more difficult case. There was some violence involved, and the person was had planned to release to their parent, and their parent, because the violence involved another family member, their parent did not want them back. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, it was a military individual. So the Bureau houses, in addition to federal cases, there's a very small number of military members that are housed, DOD, UCMJ convicted individuals. And their rules about releases and relocation is very different than for federal folks. So in his case, his physical release from prison was actually delayed because of a bad release plan. And where in the federal system, if you don't have a good release plan, you might look at a public law placement. You know, there's different things, but when you come to the end of your sentence, you're going to be released, even if you don't have someplace to go. The military isn't the same way. And his physical release from prison was delayed. They would not issue him release orders because he didn't have a valid release plan. So having that conversation is so important. This young man we're working with now, who had his custody classification all messed up and his pattern messed up, he's not planning a relocation, fortunately, because he really doesn't have that much time. Like, we're at the under 15 month window at this point. But we see it all the time. You know, people come in with shorter sentences and, you know, and I'm like, okay, like walking in the door, you need to have this conversation. You can't wait. But it's those kind of things. And that's where these books are so useful. If I could like wave my magic wand, because we get the calls after the fact and the PSR is final and it's got bad information in it, or they're already there and they don't have the relocation done yet. And they haven't talked to the team. And now this has happened and this has happened. And I'll be like, well, did you talk about your release plans? Well, I told them I hadn't decided yet. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a problem. Like, you need to make a decision. We had one client that we were talking to the father, and I'm like, he's got to have a plan. And he's like, well, his plan is to go to halfway house and get a job. Right. And I'm like, that's not a plan. That's an expectation. The expectation is, you know, you're going to go from prison to a pre-release placement. While in pre-release placement, right, you're going to get a job. You're going to work out this housing plan. Those are expectations of what you're going to do. That's not a release plan. And sometimes release planning is a challenge. You know, if you burn some bridges and that happens, you know, all kinds of things happen in prisons. Marriages end, relationships, you know, go by the wayside. And sometimes folks are starting over, literally starting over. You talked about some of, you know, the folks in certain industries, when your offense is connected to your line of work, whether that's the medical field or finance field, you know, you lose your license, you lose your ability to practice in the field. And then what are you going to do? You got to pay the bills. You got to stay out of trouble. You got to work. You got to do all those things. And that's starting from scratch. And maybe there's an opportunity to get a license restored. But how long is that going to take?
Right.
And that's not a guarantee. And kind of retooling, like, what direction are we going to go?
Exactly.
Now, the other thing we see in terms of release planning, and I'm sure you've had some of those conversations, you know, well, what are you going to do when you get out of prison for work? I can't tell you how many people were going to be a sports promoter, or they were going to write a book about their time in prison and be a famous author. They were going to go into the music industry, sports memorabilia, some of these these fields that. Not saying you can't be successful, but as I like to say, when talking to my adult children, you know, okay, that's great. That's the dream. What are you going to do between now and then to support yourself and move forward? And I think that kind of general goal planning and what do we need to get from here to there is something that I know as a case manager, I saw a lot of folks struggling with that. And it wasn't just a function of younger individuals, you know, the under 35 crowd. You also saw it with these folks that they weren't going to be able to go back to what they've done. Their education was in this area. Their licensing was in this area. Their reputation was now, you know, you Googled your name and your name comes up on the internet, and for a white collar offense, it's kind of hard to go back into the accounting field when people Google your name and your crime comes up before your web address for your practice comes up.
Right.
So I know you've done, in some of your other things do some coaching and guidance, counseling type guidance on that. Do you see it just even separate from folks in reentry struggling with that? How do they redirect and retool back. I know you do work with athletes too, that obviously their career can come to an abrupt end with an injury. And now
very abrupt ending. Yes. Yes. Very abrupt ending. So part of the counseling license is you have to have training in vocational assessment, vocational counseling, vocational assessment. And thank God I got that training. You know, I kind of scoffed at it. I was more of a clinical guy, but there I was in 2007, 2008, 2009, that Obama era housing crisis, the bubble burst. And I mean, there were a lot of men in million-dollar homes laid off. There were a lot of engineers here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that were outsourced to India for people for $7, $8, $9 an hour in India doing the same mechanical engineering, electrical engineering type of work. Long story short, man, these guys were coming in there and I was doing these tests, and I would use that data constructively for them to go onto LinkedIn or Indeed or whatever. And you know, it was a little bit older era than it is now, but we were able to get these, you know, using those vocational assessments. So there's this one thing called the Strengths Finder. And that was the best thing, because if you're dealing with somebody who's in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, right, it's kind of hard to teach an old dog new tricks. I'm not saying that, but it's just easier when you're in this kind of a clutch situation to look at their strengths, figure out a profile from that, and then
look for those transferable skills.
Right. Look for a job that's just literally plug and play and seamless or whatever. So, I do find that a lot, and I wish that, I got to tread lightly here, but I know each halfway house has a job developer, and I wish that they applied more scientific tools to as a part of your A&O process, and let's get this done. And if you don't have a job, now a lot of guys will come in, they have a job, they got a job lined up or whatever, and that's great. But there's a lot of people that don't, man. They're starting from ground zero. And so having these tools.
Yeah, I used to ask when I would be talking as a case manager, when I would be talking about reentry, and I would get asked that question, well, you know, I know you might not have a job lined up, but like, what kind of work are you going to look for? And, you know, are you going after the job? Like, this is going to be this new career path, or is this job just a stepping stone to get to the next one? And if that's the case, what is the next one? And I would try to get them to think about those next steps and not just, I'm going to go to Halfway House and get a job flipping burgers.
Right.
Okay, great. That's fine for the next 30 days. Right.
But you know what? Hold on a minute. That's some of the old school model. So if I'm the job developer at such and such Halfway House, and so I've developed relationships with companies in the community that are on the bus line, because that's part of the contract, right? How many
the transportation, right?
So I have, so guy comes in, he's a neurosurgeon. It's like, hey man, you want to cut some meat over there at Sam's, Costco, back of the job at Walmart. I got a couple of Jiffy Lube. I got a parts runner thing at O'Reilly. You know what I mean? Like,
they're just focused on the
there's your job.
It's a job.
Yeah. So it's not like I'm not looking at your streaks. I'm looking at what I have that I can give you. Get your, you know, go ahead.
And it's also about employers willing to take individuals with records of conviction. My father was a painting contractor here in Northeastern Ohio, and he was in several probation officers' Rolodex back doing painting, wallpapering, roofing. Eventually he was just doing painting, but, you know, kind of early on, and, you know, it was, hey, Russ, I got one for you. And his rule was they just had to show up and show up sober, and he would teach them. But sometimes showing up and showing up sober was a challenge, but he was willing to take those individuals that needed a second chance. And that's the other challenge for the employment developers is the is employers that are willing to bring someone on with a conviction.
But nonetheless, as it pertains to Second Chance Act, right, having that discussion, having that frank discussion early on with the case manager as they're doing their release planning and the magical five-factor review,
yep.
Right, which one of those needs is, you know, that you have a family needs and other types of needs, of course, but, you know, some sort of successful employment would be good. So,
and you know, the other thing we talk about in the book in terms of employment in the Second Chance Act is you can't do nothing in prison, right? In the employment development route, do nothing, do no programming, do no skill development, and then come to your case manager and go, oh, I need a 12-month recommendation because I'm going to need X, Y, and Z. Well, it's a much stronger sell as an individual to the unit team if you have been doing some of those other developmental work. Now, obviously, if you're in that kind of white collar situation, you know, when you're talking about potentially a career change or some other stuff, you know, is the prison necessarily going to have a lot of programming for you? Maybe not, but then maybe there's some correspondence stuff you can do.
Right.
And you need, as the person taking control of your life and your future, if you're doing things to help yourself and then coming to your team and saying, okay, while I've been here, I've taken these correspondence courses that I've been able to take, because I'm my goal is to get my license reinstated, or I'm not going to be able to get my license reinstated, but I am going to be able to do this collateral work. I've been doing these corresponding classes, but I also need to take these in-person ones that ends with a certification exam.
Yeah.
That's a plan. If you're right. For those others, you know, finishing a high school diploma, getting into those vocational classes, taking computer right. classes, the Bureau does offer, education departments offer a lot of things, and taking advantage of them.
Another thing I want to mention, and just so happens mm-hmm. that across, literally across the hall from this office right here and down a couple of doors is a staffing service, like a temp agency, but a mm-hmm. staffing service. And man, they get all kinds of folks with all kinds of criminal backgrounds, and they're placing them. So don't forget about the staffing agencies, because they get a little bit of a slide from the employers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of logistics and supply chain and warehouse jobs here. That's here in the Dallas Fort Worth area. There's some in Ohio, and some everywhere. But
these absolutely. logistics
warehouse jobs, you know, cold warehouse, cold. I know it's a bad environment, but these warehouse jobs are readily abundant, and particularly the later shifts. I had a guy who got a job at Kohl's, KOHLS,
and mm-hmm.
they have this 11 p.m. to 8 a.m. shift where you unload the trucks at night. And mm-hmm. you take the clothes and the stuff and you move it to the back of the store. And then the people in the back of the store route it to the floor. And these guys literally schlep the stuff from the 18 wheeler to the back. It's a great, and they're getting $15, $16, $17 an hour, man.
Warehouse management. I mean, that's for all the automation that goes on, that we see going on in different industries, that's still warehouse operations, warehouse management, receiving, shipping, all of those kind of related professions. While they have, like you said, if you're, you know, the off shift, the second shift job, the overnight job,
right.
But it's an in and it's a path. And kind of going something. Back to what I saw as a case manager and case management coordinator is that not thinking it through, but then coming to the unit team and expecting a 12-month placement so they can go to halfway house and figure it out. And I think it's more effective if you start right. thinking about, you start working through that and you just start mapping it out. And in the institutions, there are reentry specialists. They do have some resources. They do offer, and yes, minutes, some institutions, oh gosh, some institutions are better than others right. in terms of the kinds of program that offered through their reentry specialists. But I would encourage every single person. There are resource centers in your institution. And some of the institutions use some of those assessment tools, some of the one-stop assessment tools through the Department of Labor. So ONET tools. So
absolutely. Anyway,
so we are very excited. We are now launching the new book, and we will put links up on Facebook and the YouTube channel and all of those places. We'll put up links for the new book. And it is the Red Book, affectionately referred to as. It's a pretty red color. I really love it. But it is Unlocking Federal Halfway House and Home Confinement Under the Second Chance Act. And unlike the First Step Act, which we have pointed out, only about 65% of the folks are actually getting First Step Act benefits. Every single individual is reviewed for Second Chance Act placement. It is the legal authority that allows the Bureau to place releasing individuals in halfway house or home confinement for the final portion of their sentence. So everybody is reviewed.
Yes. And that's
everybody needs to understand.
Everybody does. So that's what I'm excited about is we're just not catering to people that are eligible for a specific benefit. Now we're this is for everybody. So super excited about that. And people just don't even know the gravity. Some people do, but just a lot of people just don't even know the gravity of this. So I'm excited to bring it. Yeah,
every day we are explaining what the Second Chance Act is every single day on the phone and online and Facebook. Yeah.
So we'll go into depth about it. When do you know that the 5-factor review has been done? When it hasn't been done? How does that get done? Who makes the final decision? Is it the case manager? Or is it somebody else that decides how much RRC placement? So we have lots of time to unpackage that and explain that to everybody. So really, really, really good. A shout out. I get stuff that y'all can't see, but we had a client that should have gone home last Monday, is going to be at his house. He checked into the halfway house, got his monitor. And he'll be home today. So I just got a little a zinger there. So congratulations. You know, sometimes, like we've talked about, you don't necessarily get home on that first day of home confinement eligibility. Sometimes, once again, there was a mistake. It wasn't calculated right. You know what I mean? Bruce and Susan are saying, this is the date. This is the date. They're trying to get the system to catch up to the actual date. We were out of time, but at least we got something. So good for the client. So anyway, alrighty then. Well, folks, fantastic show. Thanks for listening. Come see us on Facebook at Early Release from Federal Prison First Step Act. Also our First Step Act YouTube channel. Watch for the links. I actually did a YouTube live. I might do another one with some links on it. I got a TikTok account, but trying to figure that out. But I'll probably start on TikTok, Susan, doing just the Red Book stuff. I'm not going to do any salesman stuff or anything like that. I was like, hey, here's the book, here's the link. Thanks so much, you know, and kind of get in and out of there, man.
We might be a little old for the TikTok generation.
Well, but we're, you know what?
Are you going to try?
Dip my toe in there and see, you know, especially for the books, man. I mean,
absolutely.
You can't go wrong with the books, and then people can always call us with questions.
Absolutely. So,
well, with that, we'll bid everybody a great week. We'll see you here next time. That's right. With more great information here on Around the Block on LA Talk Radio. So everybody have a great week. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.